Chapter 5. The History of Witchcraft in Greece. As a recap to remember the information better, don't let anybody tell you Wicca is not, by definition, witchcraft. The practice is all over the world and people need protection from it, which only comes with first accepting Jesus Christ as your Savior. Then, when you are a Christian, in the name and the authority of Jesus Christ, you do not have to be afraid of anything. We also looked at the history of witchcraft, which again proved there is nothing new under the sun. In fact, witchcraft dates back to ancient times with the Tower of Babel that was located in what is now modern-day Iraq. Just like the Bible records for us, witchcraft spread from Babylon to Egypt as we see from the hieroglyphics, spells and incantations, on Egyptian walls inside their pyramids, as well as on coffins and papyri. Egypt followed hard on the heels of Babylon, with witchcraft everywhere in their society, just as it was in Babylon. The name of the Egyptian god, Heka, literally meant witchcraft, as does today's Wicca. Heka was the Egyptian word for magic. They were not only soaked in witchcraft during their lives, but also after death, as we can see from what came out of their extensive practices, the Book of the Dead. Those practicing Egyptian witchcraft included lector priests at the top, as well as healing priests, scorpion charmers and even the midwives, among others. Every aspect of society was into witchcraft. They carried around witchcraft amulets and used wands like those in the Harry Potter series. Egyptians also had curses. All that probably explains part of the reason God sent the 10 plagues. When God said, "Let my people go," he was not just talking about slavery. That also meant, "Get my people away from that witchcraft." Every one of those plagues that God put to Egypt was an attack on one of their false deities they worshipped in their practice of witchcraft. Also, according to the Bible, which again and again agrees with the archaeological history, we see that the society, arising after Egypt, was Greece. And that is exactly where the extensive practice of witchcraft went next. As I mentioned, that was mind-blowing for me after us being taught all our lives to revere the Greeks philosophers like Aristotle and my son's favorite, Plato, whose color dough he played with all the time while growing up. Hey, you try to make this stuff funny, right? Pray for me. Of course, I mean, Plato. Believe it or not, a lot of these ancient philosophers and mathematicians were involved with witchcraft. But before we get into that, let's once again remind ourselves why God doesn't like witchcraft, whether it's in the past or future. From the beginning to the end of the Bible, God tells us to stay away from witchcraft. In fact, here in the last book of the Bible, in the final chapter, of all things forgot to bring up as his final warning in Revelation 22:12-15, here is what Jesus says.
"Behold, I am coming soon. My reward is with me, and I will give to each person according to what they have done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Blessed are those who wash their robes, get saved through Jesus, that they may have the right to the tree of life and may go through the gates into the city."
As we saw with the Egyptians, they thought they not only needed witchcraft in this life, but also for their afterlife where they would supposedly take a perilous journey, hoping to escape a god's punishment by having a beetle over their heart to cover their lies. Of course, that's an obvious bunch of baloney because we only need to get saved by accepting Jesus' free gift of his sacrifice for us, which will allow us into the gates of heaven. Revelation continues.
"Outside are the dogs, those who practice magic arts, the sexually immoral, the murderers, the idolaters and everyone who loves and practices falsehood."
The word magic is pharmakos in the Greek, which is where we get pharmakia, that is the practice of using drugs with occult teachings. As we saw earlier, in the first five books of the Bible, there are accounts about calling out witchcraft, including the Tower of Babel, in Genesis as well as Deuteronomy and Leviticus, where God says to stay away from the abomination of witchcraft. So, all that is right there at the beginning, then all the way through to the very last chapter and page of the Bible, where, one last time, God is saying what sounds like, "I'm telling you people that you better pay attention to this, do not get involved with witchcraft." Think about that. God could have listed any one of a huge number of possible sins, but what made the list there at the beginning, throughout, and then was even reiterated at the end? It is the abomination of witchcraft. God is displeased with it because the practice leads people straight to hell. Those who get involved with the occult don't get saved through Jesus Christ, so they will not make it through the gates to heaven. This is a serious issue and a satanic trap God is warning about. Practicing witchcraft is no way to live in this life and not how we get to the next. I like what one guy said.
"God is a god of miracles. Satan is a performer of magic."
All the devil has is magic tricks, Witchcraft. Satan does have considerable power, but it's nothing compared to God. Relative to God, the amount of Satan's power is no more than a dust particle on the hair of a flea. And the devil's power is even counterfeit, being made up of the lies, trickery, and the occult practice, including witchcraft. It is enough power to dupe us into thinking it's something special, like what God can do, but it's not at all and instead leads us astray, ultimately ending up in hell. That is why God doesn't like it. But contrary to God's wishes, people practice it today and have all throughout history, including where it started in Babylon and then spread to Egypt and Greek witchcraft culture. Just as the others before it, Greece was steeped in occult witchcraft. But usually, when we think of Greek history and culture, it is not witchcraft. Instead, normally the Greek gods and mythology come to mind. Greek mythology has all the battles of titans and giants, but we don't tend to think of the Greeks as being involved in witchcraft. Well, they certainly were in a big way, so let's start with Greek witchcraft, by taking a look at the top 10 Greek gods in this video transcript.
Narrator. For this list, we've chosen our entries based on a combination of a deity's power, popularity, and position in the Greek pantheon. Number 10, Artemis, goddess of the hunt, the twin sister of Apollo. Artemis let her brother pluck the strings of the lyre. She was far more interested in plucking the strings of the bow. In addition to being the goddess of the hunt, she was also a goddess of fertility and childbirth, a neat trick for someone known as a virgin goddess. Artemis was happiest away from Olympus when she could run around the forest hunting with her virgin nymphs, works for us. Number 9, Hermes, god of thieves and travelers, the messenger of the gods. Hermes was quite a trickster. As a baby, he enraged his big brother, Apollo, by sneakily stealing all his cattle. Fortunately, Hermes created the lyre for Apollo, which smoothed things over. Later, Hermes took the job of accompanying dead souls to the underworld. He was known for his distinctive style, usually sporting a winged cap and carrying a caduceus, you know, that stick with the wings and snakes wrapped around it. Number 8, Aphrodite, goddess of love, born out of the foam of the sea. Aphrodite was, to put it bluntly, a hottie, so hot that Zeus quickly married her off to his son, Hephaestus, to keep the rest of the gods from fighting over her. But this goddess of love much preferred her brother-in-law, Ares, the god of war, must have made for some interesting family dinners. Number 7, Ares, god of war. Ares talking to Aphrodite on the television show, Xena, warrior princess, danger excites you, and as you know, I am somewhat dangerous.
Narrator.
It's a good thing Aphrodite liked Ares, somebody had to.
Ares, that's the important thing. Narrator. With his mean streak and warlike disposition, the other Olympians tended to find him a little hard to handle.
He usually hung out with some of the less sociable gods like the gods of fear and terror and the goddess of discord. Proving that love is stronger than war, the child of Ares and Aphrodite is Harmonia, the goddess of harmony. Number 6, Apollo, god of music and light, the handsomest of the gods. Apollo kept his hand in everything. In addition to music and light, he is also associated with prophecy, medicine, plague, poetry, and a lot more busy guy. The Greeks held the Pythian Games every 4 years in Apollo's honor.
These eventually became what we know as the Olympics. So, if you want your country to bring home the gold, a little sacrifice to Apollo may be in order.
Number 5, Hera, goddess of marriage. The queen of the Olympian gods, Hera was the goddess of marriage, but that didn't stop her husband, Zeus, from cheating on her every time she turned her back. Hera was vindictive and mercilessly punished the women Zeus dallied with, and their kids, too, but she was revered by the Greeks, who honored her prominence in Olympus and her importance as a symbol of the family. Hera talking to Zeus in the movie, Jason and the Argonauts.
You think it weak of me, my lord? Zeus. Not weak, almost human. Narrator.
Number 4, Hades, god of the underworld, the ruler of the dead. Hades is not one of your life of the party gods. Zeus talking to Hades in the movie, Hercules.
How are things in the underworld?
Hades. Well, they're just fine, you know, a little dark, a little gloomy, and as always, full of dead people.
What are you gonna do? Narrator.
Hey, if you spent most of your time in a dark, sunless realm with moaning souls as company, you'd brood too. Still, there were some cool things about being in Hades, he had all the gold and silver he wanted and an awesome helmet of invisibility.
Take that, Harry Potter.
Hades speaking after his horse blows out his flaming hair.
Whoa, is my hair out?
Narrator. Number 3, Athena, goddess of wisdom. Like Aphrodite, Athena had an unusual birth. When Zeus complained of a fierce headache, Hephaestus split his head open with an axe and out popped Athena, goddess of wisdom.
Now, that is how to make an entrance.
Athena was the patroness of the city of Athens, to which she gave a most precious gift, the olive tree.
Greek cuisine would have been much poorer without her.
Number 2, Poseidon, god of the sea. Much like the sea, over which he was the god, Poseidon was one moody character. One day he's happily creating little islands in a smooth-as-glass sea, the next day it's all hurricanes and earthquakes.
Poseidon was one dude you did not want to have as your enemy.
After all, it wouldn't have taken Odysseus 10 years to get back from the Trojan War if he hadn't blinded Poseidon's son and then bragged about it. Before we unveil our top pick, here are a few honorable mentions: Hephaestus, god of fire; Hestia, goddess of the hearth; Demeter, goddess of the harvest; Dionysus, god of wine.
Number 1, Zeus, god of the sky. Zeus, the king of the gods, was even more powerful than his brother, Poseidon, and also someone you didn't want to get in a snit. He had a tendency to hurl thunderbolts.
Zeus ruled over Olympus with a firm hand and loved his wife, Hera, but couldn't seem to keep things in his toga.
The number of illegitimate children he fathered is titanic.
Fortunately, his kids treated him better than Zeus did his own father. After overthrowing him, Zeus had him castrated.
Hey, do those sound like some wonderful gods to serve as our role models? No. Again, that is just a quick overview, but we could spend weeks studying the Greek gods, even though it's all a bunch of baloney. And one of the sad parts is that, even though Greece was founded not long after the flood, the Grecians had already backslid, degenerating into that craziness. Now, to deal with all their belief in these Greek gods, first we have to understand that multiple deities is not only unbiblical, it's also illogical. Whether we use the biblical or secular definition, God is supreme, which means that no other being is like him. There is no other God. How could God be supreme if there are other gods? It is illogical. And the Bible says God is eternal, he cannot die. Yet, Greek mythology shows their supposed gods killing each other. Scripture also tells us God is holy. He does nothing wrong, so he commits no sins. But what kind of beings are these Greek gods? They're just as sinful as man, because the mind of a man made them. They are not real gods. The Bible is clear when it tells us there is only one God, period. Here are some of those verses.
Deuteronomy 4:35. You were shown these things so that you might know that the Lord is God, beside him there is no other. Deuteronomy 4:39. Acknowledge and take to heart this day that the Lord is God in heaven above and on earth below. There is no other. 1 Kings 8:60. So that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord is God and that there is no other. Isaiah 44:8. Did I not proclaim this and foretell it long ago? You are my witnesses. Is there any God besides me? No, there is no other rock, I know not one. Isaiah 45:5. I am the Lord, and there is no other, apart from me there is no God.
Unfortunately, even after God's judgment with a worldwide flood, and then another at the Tower of Babel, Babylon and Egypt did not want to listen. As we will see in this chapter, neither did the Greeks. And with all three, it was not just that they got involved in polytheism, many gods, they each were also heavily into witchcraft. Just like Babylon and Egypt before them, the witchcraft religion of the Greeks was everywhere in their society, which illustrates what the Bible says about how we will all be worshipping something, even if we decide not to worship our Creator, God. Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes that God has set eternity in our hearts, yet no one can fathom what he has done. One strong argument for the existence of God is that every culture on the planet innately wants to worship something higher than themselves. Where did that idea come from? It came from God so that we would desire to seek him out. But again, unfortunately, Satan uses that to lead people down the wrong path. The Greeks had different cities and tribes that worshipped a large variety of gods. It was originally a hodgepodge, but by the 6th century BC they had narrowed it down to what they called the Pantheon, meaning all gods. Pan is all. The pantheon was made up of their 12 big guns they called the Olympians. So, they were still worshipping a lot of gods but narrowed the total to 12. And unfortunately, the whole idea of multiple gods, like the Greek pantheon, is a belief we're seeing a resurgence in today. As you can see, today we have a pantheon mentality being pushed across the world by a false prophet, or pope, who is leading the effort. Proponents of this ecumenical movement say, let's all just worship together, we all just need to get along, and we must have only one central place of worship. And guess where the prescribed place for that focal point is? It is the Catholic Vatican in Rome. In fact, Catholicism and the rest who are pushing for a one-world religion, want to build a universal worship center in Jerusalem, which is why they have their feet and nose involved with everything going on in Israel. With that ecumenical effort today, we are seeing a resurgence of the Greeks' polytheistic pantheon attitude. Now, when we think of the pantheon structure, this is the place that comes to mind. The Pantheon of Rome was built from 27 BC through 14 AD. It was dedicated to the idea of all gods from all religions coming together in what is called syncretism. To use a similar and popular word of today, Rome's theology was sort of multicultural. And here is something I found interesting. The Pantheon was later renovated and used as a Catholic church in 609 AD, under Pope Boniface IV. So, this center for the worship of multiple gods was a place that Catholicism moved into, while the same organization today just happens to be leading the exact same sort of movement with a pantheon-type attitude. Now, let's get back to those 12 Olympians, who supposedly had their headquarters on Mount Olympus. I won't give you a detailed look at all them, but we will look deeper into the more prominent Greek gods like Zeus, Hera, Poseidon, and Demeter. Mount Olympus is an actual mountain in Greece. As we saw earlier, somehow these gods lived on top of that mountain where they supposedly gathered to do all that evil, sinful, and rotten behavior. For being gods, they were very ungodly. And in the next chapter we will see that those ungodly gods from Greek witchcraft were transferred to the later civilization of the Romans practicing witchcraft. As the Greek culture's world dominance faded, the Romans came in and took over, borrowing a lot of their beliefs from Greece, including the Greek gods. All Rome did was change the gods' names. The Greek god Zeus became Jupiter. Hera was changed to Juno, Poseidon to Neptune, Demeter to Ceres, Athena to Minerva, Apollo stayed Apollo, Artemis became Diana, Ares was changed to Mars, Aphrodite to Venus, and Hephaestus, the god who supposedly invented fire, became Vulcan, which is obviously where Star Trek Spock got his cool techniques. Hermes became Mercury, Hestia turned into Vesta, and Dionysus was converted to Bacchus. Why is it important to trace that trail? It is because that same witchcraft that passed from Greece to the Roman Empire was still in power when Jesus showed up and the church was born. The Greek temples were still in existence as the church was saving people from their teachings. And when you understand what was going on in these temples, it helps explain some of the sins the early church was still struggling with, including the Church of Corinth. That is what's left today of Poseidon's temple in Corinth. If you read 1st and 2nd Californians, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, you'll see that that church there in Corinth was messed up. Praise God, His love for them is an example of how wide, deep, and wonderful His love, grace, and mercies are to still care for a church like them. Paul had to address the Corinthians' issues, and it took him two books. Besides Poseidon's temple, Corinth also had the temple of Apollo that you can see of the ruins still to this day. Ephesus also had occult issues, as evidenced by one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, which was a massive structure called the Temple of Artemis. Act 19 records that this actual location of that enormous tribute to Artemis is where Paul caused a citywide ruckus and riot by the people. But back in those days, the authorities knew how to put riots, unlike some of our cities today. Let's look at Act 19:17-41, which is a long passage, but we need to deal with it because these verses show that the people of that day not only worshipped Artemis, but it was also the practice of witchcraft.
When this became known to the Jews and Greeks living in Ephesus, they were all seized with fear, and the name of the Lord Jesus was held in a high honor. Many of those who believed, born again, now came and openly confessed their evil deeds. A number who had practiced sorcery, witchcraft, brought their scrolls together and burned them publicly. When they calculated the value of the scrolls, the total came to 50,000 drachmas. In this way the word of the Lord spread widely and grew in power.
In those days, a drachma was one full day's wages. So, those people burned up 50,000 days of their labor. In today's money, that is millions they just chucked into the fire. This history also demonstrates the kind of funds it took for those involved in witchcraft to buy their scrolls with their spells and incantations.
After this happened, Paul decided to go to Jerusalem, passing through Macedonia and Achaia. "After I have been there," he said, "I must visit Rome also." He sent two of his helpers, Timothy and Erastus, to Macedonia while he stayed in the province of Asia a little longer. About that time there arose a great disturbance about the way. A silversmith named Demetrius, who made silver shrines at Artemis, the temple of Artemis, brought in no little business for the craftsmen. This was a money-making scheme. He called them together, along with the workmen in related trades, and said, "Men, you know how we have received a good income from this business. And you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. He says that man-made gods are no gods at all."
Yes, that's right. Paul had been reading his Bible. What a concept.
"There is danger not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited, and the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty." When they heard this, they were furious and began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Soon the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and rushed as one man into the theater. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. The assembly was in confusion, some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there.
Boy. Doesn't that not sound just like our society here in 2020 with all the senseless riots?
The Jews pushed Alexander to the front, and some of the crowd shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. But when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" These guys went nuts. The city clerk quieted the crowd and said, "Men of Ephesus, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of her image, which fell from heaven? Therefore, since these facts are undeniable, you ought to be quiet and not to do anything rash. You have brought these men here, though they have neither robbed temples nor blasphemed our goddess. If then, Demetrius and his fellow craftsmen have a grievance against anybody, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. They can press charges. If there is anything further you want to bring up, it must be settled in a legal assembly. As it is, we are in danger of being charged with rioting because of today's events. In that case, we would not be able to account for this commotion, since there is no reason for it." After he had said this, he dismissed the assembly.
They apparently knew how to deal with riots, unlike our pre-election time here in 2020. These people in Bible times did not stand down the police, to allow thugs to loot and burn down businesses. They understood it was a bad idea to let mobs take over parts of cities. Here's my point in bringing that up, and remember that the church was still dealing with this kind of worship when the Romans got it from the Greeks and just changed the name for Artemis to Diana. Artemis in Ephesus, Diana to the Romans, was their goddess of hunting and wilderness, as well as the supposed protector of unmarried girls. Her temple was considered one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And Artemis, Diana, was also called the Queen of Heaven, which emphasized her fertility, protection, and childbearing. With that in mind, when you study Catholicism like we did in great detail with our series, Roman Catholicism and the Coming World Religion, that description of Artemis, the Roman Diana, sounds familiar because it is exactly what the Catholics have done in practice with Mary, even to the point of also calling her the Queen of Heaven. It makes me wonder where they got that title. First, we see how Roman Catholicism took over the pagan Roman pantheon building that housed all the Roman gods, which is similar to the mindset Catholicism pushes today, with all the Catholic saints. Then Catholicism copied the Greek Artemis, Roman Diana, worship with their Queen of Heaven, only repackaging it as worshiping Mary, as the Catholic Queen of Heaven. I'm also bringing all this up for another point that the Book of Acts mentions. When Acts talks about the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus, what was the context? These new Christians were not just getting saved and walking away from Artemis, it also meant they were leaving witchcraft because temple worship was heavily involved in it. Going back to all the Greek gods, if you are unsure whether witchcraft permeated the Greek culture, they actually had the goddess, Hecate, who was literally their goddess of witchcraft. In fact, some reports say she is the most ancient of the Greek gods, possibly influenced from Egypt, which also fits the biblical account. Let's take a look at their goddess of witchcraft in this video transcript.
Hecate was the goddess of magic, the lady of witches and sorcerers. She is the daughter of the Titan, Perses, the god of destruction, and Titaness, Asteria. So, Hecate, also a Titaness, was a very powerful goddess and exercised her power in heaven, earth, and in the underworld. However, during the War of Titans, she became an ally of Zeus, and for this she kept her powers and escaped from the prison in Tartarus. Even though she is a rather worshipped deity in ancient Greece, the goddess was a friend of the goddess, Demeter, and helped her to find her daughter, Persephone, who had been kidnapped by Hades. Making use of her torches during nighttime searches, after having found Persephone, Hecate started to have the underworld as her dwelling place. The goddess is also cited as one of the participants of the clash between gods and giants known as the Gigantomachy, in which she fought alongside the gods of Olympus and was accountable for exterminating the giant, Clytius. The goddess of magic is also the mother of one of the most famous witches of Greek mythology. Her name is Circe, and her encounter with the hero, Ulysses, has been immortalized in the Odyssey. Hecate was also the goddess of the crossroads, the place where her offerings were made. And so, the goddess guided her worshippers throughout the best paths. She is then considered to be the protector of travelers. Hecate is often represented by three bodies or three heads because she was regarded as a threefold goddess that had traits of a woman who was young, ancient, and a mother. The goddess was also a deity connected to births and deaths. Since Hecate is a goddess that rules passages, which are symbolized by doors, keys are a symbol of Hecate. The records of the goddess's worship are extremely old, considering that Hecate is a really ancient goddess of Asian origin, and her worship was also present in ancient Greece long before the arrival of worship of the Olympic gods. The worship of the goddess of magic remains alive today, being performed mainly by people who have been initiated in the arts of magic and sorcery. And if, during these rituals, dog barking is heard, then Hecate is around.
Actually, that would be a demon. But that is their goddess of witchcraft legend. And as you saw, Hecate is one of the very oldest that came on the scene before all the other supposed gods. And this practice still goes on today because this is nothing new under the sun. Modern witchcraft is also called neo-paganism, which means new paganism, so it is just a revival of old paganism. And we see a massive resurgence of that today, extending all the way to us from its origins that certainly come from as far back as the Greeks, who most likely got it from the Egyptians. In fact, in Wicca today, Hecate is considered the triple goddess, which is their version of the old crone witch, again, no family relation to me. So, even this ancient worship of the goddess of witchcraft is still being practiced today in societies around the world, including ours. Hecate is often shown holding a pair of torches or a key, which is associated with her supposed job at the crossroads between one world and the next. So, you have to get through her to go where you would like to end up. But that whole realm would be a demonic course in a demonic place. Hecate is associated with magic, witchcraft, herbs, poisons, plants, necromancy, and sorcery. Some say Hecate's origin goes all the way back to an Egyptian witchcraft goddess of similar spelling. Hecate is often shown with the head of a frog on a woman's body. Like the Greek goddess, Hecate, Hecate is also associated with borders, walls, doorways, crossroads, and realms between the two worlds. Hecate was considered a household deity who protects those things associated with your home and family. And similarly, there is a Hecatean shrine built to worship Hecate, also supposedly for protection of a home. This shrine was normally wood or stone carving with the larger ones enclosed in small walled areas that became a sort of enclave for the people's Hecate witch idol. Can you see where this description fits another religion we have today? This demonstrates more pattern of similarities with Catholicism's Mary worship. As you can see there, Catholics are taught a parallel practice for Mary. They like to put her in a bathtub. At least, that is what I see, though it's a variation with the shrine being put upright and around her. Mary statues are promoted by the Roman Catholic Church. Like Hecate, she is said to protect a Catholic's home and family. Anyone else see a pattern there? Once you learn the history, including that of witchcraft and the occult, you'll understand that many of the unbiblical practices in the supposedly Christian religions, like Catholicism, are actually just recycled paganism that includes witchcraft. Now, adding even more weight to the apt comparison of pagan worship and Catholicism, is another practice of Hecate worship, offering the goddess food. Exactly the same practice as what we see that Catholic leadership continues to teach today for their Mary. That again proves how this is nothing new under the sun, because it's the exact same practice from witchcraft. I brought up the Bible passage about the Ephesians in the book of Acts, not only because Hecate was worshipped with shrines, having her own sanctuary in Roman homes, but also to point out that she was given her own space in many temples of the day. This goddess of witchcraft was that prevalent and important. In fact, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus had a sacred area set aside for Hecate. So, it is no wonder Act 19 gives us the history of how those craftsmen were freaking out over what was happening around their Temple of Artemis. Followers of the Roman gods were getting saved out of that god and goddess worship going on in the temple. At the same time, they were also being freed from the Hecate witchcraft practice happening at her shrine in the Temple of Artemis. So, we learn something new every day, although this information is only new to us. The Greeks had other witch entities, one of which relates to the present-day Mormon cult. If you've seen our study, Mormonism and the Occult Behavior of Joseph Smith, you know that the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, was part of a whole family of witches. And this witch named his new religion, Mormon, which makes sense for him because the Greeks had a witch called Mormo. In fact, the actual spelling for that witch is Mormon. As we saw in our large study of Mormonism, Joseph Smith was a liar, con artist, plagiarist, and heavily into witchcraft, as was his entire family. In fact, the lying Joseph Smith claimed his Book of Mormon came from God when it was actually plagiarized from a whole bunch of other books, a mishmash that included the name Mormon, which actually came from the Greek witch, Mormon, or Mormo, who was used by the Romans as their bogeyman.
Mormo, or Mormon, was a female spirit in Greek folklore, whose name was invoked by mothers and nurses to frighten children to keep them from misbehaving. The name Mormo has the plural form Mormones, which means fearful ones or hideous ones, and is related to an array of words that signify fright.
Hey man, don't let the Mormones get you. I'm telling you, Joseph Smith was con artist and not even original. He stole the name of his new religion straight from his own practice of witchcraft. In this case it was Greek sorcery.
The name of Mormo or the synonymous Mormolisaion was used by the Greeks as a bugbear or bogey word to frighten children.
So again, kids, don't let the Mormons get you. But do try to help them come to Jesus when possible. Another Greek witch was one that should not be confused with Grandma's excellent clear gelatinous dessert that seemed to have wood shavings put inside but were only grated carrots and the see-through grapes that came from a can and looked like they were 1,000 years old. Remember that growing up? That is not what we are talking about here with a Greek witch named Gelo. But maybe that Jello dessert somehow came out of witchcraft.
Gelo, in Greek mythology, is a female demon who threatens the reproductive cycle by causing infertility, miscarriage, and infant mortality. Women believed to be under demonic possession by Gelo might stand trial or be subjected to exorcism. Jilu, Jilu, Gilo, or Gelo are some of its alternate forms. Gelo possibly derives from Gala, a Babylonian Assyrian demon believed to bring sickness and death.
Again, you're seeing a direct connection from Rome back to Greece and even earlier with Egypt. And the origin was Babylon, which agrees exactly with the biblical account. Here are a couple more interesting aspects of Gelo in relationship to our world today. Gelo is also the source of our modern-day word, ghoul, and she was supposed to be a young woman who came from the Isle of Lesbos. If that sounds familiar, it is because Lesbos is exactly where we get the word, lesbian. It comes from this island that this Greek witch character, Gelo, came from. And that is fitting because, if you know anything much about witchcraft today, you probably know that lesbianism is rampant in that culture, with young girls especially being targeted by Wicca. So, it all comes straight out of witchcraft. Hey, we can learn something new every day when we don't only rely on the back of granola bars for information. They will never tell you that one. Now, here is another Greek witch. Lamia is supposedly a child-eating monster that, just like Mormo, was used as a bogeyman, or bogeywoman in this case, to discipline or motivate good behavior in children by frightening them. Hey, if the Mormus knocking at your door don't get you, Lamia will, right? She is described as having serpentine qualities like the drawing above where she is half woman and half snake. This next Greek entity is a lady you would not want to invite out for lunch, or you may become the meal. And I am not sure why the woman has a copper leg, but maybe she was attacked by pirates.
Empusa is a shape-shifting female being in Greek mythology, said to possess a single leg of copper, commanded by Hecate, whose precise nature is obscure, although thought to seduce and feed on young men.
She also supposedly possessed the shape-shifting ability to turn into animals. So, all that about the Greek witches was to give you an idea of how deeply these people were into witchcraft, so much so that they had many witch entities in their culture, including those used to scare their kids. Fortunately, as we saw in Acts 19, people got saved out of witchcraft from the Greek temples. But the practice was pervasive in that society, which included their Greek philosophers and mathematicians who were heavy duty into witchcraft. Let me give you just two examples that will make you wonder if we should even listen to those so-called philosophers. Here is the first one, who gave us the Pythagorean theorem.
The Pythagorean theorem states that the area of the square whose side is the hypotenuse, the side opposite the right angle, is equal to the sum of the areas of the squares on the other two sides.
If you didn't like memorizing that while growing up, blame it on this guy, who was into witchcraft. And that's even a future excuse for you to avoid math. Here is some of what Aristotle recorded about how Pythagoras used magical powers, witchcraft.
Some of the magical acts attributed to him include being seen at the same hour in two cities, a white eagle permitting him to stroke it, a river greeting him with the words, "Hail, Pythagoras," and predicting that a dead man would be found on a ship entering a harbor.
Hey, that last one is no big deal. We all know those ships sometimes serve chicken. Other acts Aristotle attributed to Pythagoras were
predicting the appearance of a white bear, biting a venomous snake to death, his ability to control animals and to transcend space, and at times showing he has been touched by the gods.
No, he was involved in witchcraft. We were never taught this history, so we don't think about these philosophers being occult figures. But they were. Let me give another and then we'll move on.
Empedocles was a combination of a poet, magus, teacher, and scientist.
Being a magus means he was involved in witchcraft. Empedocles was influenced by Pythagoras, who taught him the tools of the witchcraft trade.
In his poem Purifications, he claimed miraculous powers, including the destruction of evil, the curing of old age, and the controlling of the wind and rain.
He even went to the Far East to learn more about witchcraft, and here is something interesting we got from this guy that is still with us today. The four elements apparently came from Empedocles, who historians will say was a great philosopher. No, he was an occult practitioner performing witchcraft. Empedocles was also a vegetarian, which is another practice in our modern-day Wicca witchcraft, as is lesbianism.
Empedocles advocated vegetarianism since the bodies of animals are the dwelling places of punished souls.
Obviously, it ruins a meal when the meat has been seasoned with punished souls. But often we have been told that benevolent ethical vegetarians came up with this modern-day concern for the environment and saving animals. No, it is just more of the same old-fashioned witchcraft that comes from as far back as the Greeks. The research shows it was an idea from this Empedocles guy. Again, just like Babylon and Egypt, Greece was permeated with witchcraft. In fact, whole cities would perform witchcraft to supposedly protect their areas. Archaeologists have found a ton of witchcraft evidence in Greece. Just like Babylon's cuneiform tablets and the writing on Egyptian pyramids, coffins and the scrolls, the Greeks cataloged their witchcraft on what they called the Greek magical papyri. These papyri are a giant Greek magic catalog of magic spells, formulas, hymns and rituals. And because of the book burnings, as mentioned in the book of Acts 19:19, it is believed that what they have is just part of a larger magical book collection. Obviously, not everyone got saved at that time of Acts, so some of the material was preserved, including papyrus pieces that were apparently working manuals for traveling magicians. These people were flooded with witchcraft in their society.
The pages contain spells, recipes, formulae, and prayers, interspersed with magic words and often in shorthand. These spells range from impressive and mystical summonings of dark gods and demons, to folk remedies and even parlor tricks, from portentous, fatal curses, to love charms, and cures for impotence and minor medical complaints. In many cases, the formulaic words and phrases are strikingly similar to those found in Egypt.
We're just following the historical, biblical trail, which again shows God's account is spot on. The other items often found were figurines, just like those meant for protection that the Catholic Church sells to their followers today. Are you seeing the pattern? Archaeologists also found voodoo dolls that are said to probably be where the Haitians got voodoo, showing once more that there is nothing new under the sun. Now, let's quickly list the categories of these archaeological finds, with the first being spells. Many spells found were written on lead tablets, which had naturally been well preserved. The Greeks would use spells for everything, including restraining spells for controlling anger, enchantments that women used on husbands to supposedly make them do whatever the wife desired, maybe like taking the trash out, and protection from problems, like wild animals, aquatic creatures, and even robbers. And I kid you not, another was the indispensable invisibility spell, which could apparently be employed with the following witchcraft technique.
Take fat or an eye of a night owl and a ball of dung rolled by a beetle and oil of an unripe olive and grind them all together until smooth, and smear your whole body with it and say to Helios, I adjure you by your great name. And moisten it and say in addition, make me invisible, Lord Helios, in the presence of any man until sunset.
And the reason it worked was because people could smell you coming and left before you got there. Now, that is a high level of crazy. Can you believe that? They also had spells for positive dreams, so-called revelations, and self-improvement. And guess what they did with their memory spells? Sorry, I don't remember. You probably saw that one was coming. They had a strength spell, where a person would hold his or her thumbs while repeating 7 times, give me strength for I am Abrasax. As we saw before, Abrasax was the Greek form of the witch word, abracadabra. There were also spells for gaining favor, doing better in business, assertiveness, healing, a cough, migraines, scorpion stings, picking out plants, obtaining herbs, and contraceptive purposes. Are you getting the idea? Sometimes the picture we get of Greek society is of wise-looking people standing around in white togas as they talk philosophy. No, folks, these people were practicing witches. Just like Babylon and Egypt before them, everyone in society was involved in witchcraft. And besides spells, the Greeks were involved in potions and drugs. A prominent Greek god, that was the god of wine, Bacchus, who the Romans later called Dionysius. People liked that god because those societies drank a lot of wine, which was a drug they could really get goofy on. In fact, even today alcohol in the occult is used to get a person into an altered state of consciousness, opening him or her up to demonic entities that most people would not want to spend time with. The Greeks mixed alcohol with other ingredients to make potion and other concoctions. And as mentioned, they even had voodoo dolls. That is a picture of one they actually found, a small female effigy kneeling with her feet together and arms tied behind her back. These sorts of statuettes are called colossoi, and they have found them all over ancient Greece.
She is pierced with 13 pins, one in the top of her head, one in the mouth, one in each eye, one in each ear, one each in the solar plexus, vagina and anus, one in the palm of each hand, and in the soles of each foot. The effigy was wrapped in an inscribed table and sealed in a pit.
Someone did not like this woman. Actually, you would think whoever stuck those pins in the doll wanted to hurt the woman it represented, but listen to the instructions found with this figurine.
The doll surprisingly was commissioned by a man who wanted the victim, a woman, to live with him. The text of the tablet read, Li Ptolemaisi, who Aeus bore, the daughter of Horigens, to me. Prevent her from eating and drinking until she comes to me. Do not allow her to have an experience with another man, except me alone. Drag her by her hair, by her guts, until she does not stand aloof from me.
As you can tell, there were no dating services back then. Can you believe that? It's crazy, but that's how pervasive witchcraft was in Greek society. They also had charms or talismans, as we saw with the earlier civilizations. These guys would make their charms into rings for supposed powers like bringing on certain moods and for good luck. Based on the gemstone, these items were said to grant certain abilities like dendrite for love of the gods and success in the world, or sapphire for victory, including lawsuits. Arizon was placed in a gold ring, supposedly making it effective around leaders. In fact, listen to this from their beliefs.
There were many cases in Greek cultures where social inferiors would stand before their superiors armed only with a magical stone set in a ring. They were hoping that the rings would increase their goodwill and help them build favorable relationships with the hierarchy. A little ring for success and for charm, paras and for victory. The world has nothing better than this. For when you have it with you, you will always get whatever you ask from anybody. Besides, it calms the angers, or guy, of kings and master. Wearing it, whatever you may say to anyone, you will be believed, and you will be pleasing to everybody.
The other witchcraft tools of the Greeks were curses. They cursed anything and everything you could possibly think of. I mean, these guys were vindictive. And the whole practice was a huge money-making scam. In fact, there were so many curses that certain cities outlawed them. But here are some of the different tasks that curses were used for.
One would inscribe the victim's name and a formula on a lead tablet, fold it up, often pierce it with a nail, and then deposit it in a grave or a well or a fountain, placing it in the realm of ghosts or underworld divinities.
The Greeks used curses for the kinds of things like sporting competitions and legal contests. Those who purchased these witchcraft tools were people like potters, shop owners, and tavern owners, who wanted to take out competing businesses. They even directed curses at politicians. Some curse tablets had spelling and grammar mistakes, most likely meaning an amateur sold those. Everyone who wanted to earn a silver coin was whipping out these written curses. In fact, just like our modern time has seen with books, knives, vacuums, and encyclopedias, Greeks actually had professional sorcerers that went around selling curses door to door. For any younger people reading this who might not know, look up the word encyclopedia on the internet. It was our old-fashioned way to store knowledge. But here is more of the door-to-door sorcerers.
And then there are the begging sorcerers, who were going to the doors of the wealthy to persuade them that, if anyone wants to harm an enemy, whether the enemy is a just or unjust man, the sorcerers, at very little expense, will do it with incantations and binding spells, since they claim they have persuaded the gods to do their bidding.
They literally sold those things door to door. Also, like the previous civilizations, the Greeks also got into amulets. Farmers were big into amulets, wearing them in rings or around their necks to supposedly increase the rain that would help their crops grow. Greeks also had talismans and amulets made from just about everything, including wood, stone, bone, and gemstones. As we saw in the previous civilizations, the Greeks also had amulets for supposed protection from things like the evil eye. You might find this one in some druid shops today. The cornicillo horn links back to Greek mythology and the term cornucopia. Cornucopia is a symbol of fertility since Zeus supposedly broke the horn off a goat, filled it with fruit and flowers, and gave it to the caretaker. As you can see, cornucopia baskets are shaped like a horn. But again, the Greeks used amulets for everything you could possibly think of, like attracting love, protection, and cursing others. Their witchcraft was everywhere in their society, so much so that Plato sought to punish the sellers of spells and curse tablets, while other philosophers wanted to eradicate the practice. The Greeks weren't just a bunch of lofty postulating, toga-wearing mathematicians. That society was deeply involved in witchcraft. For those of us thinking we're lucky, we don't have to put up with this baloney of multiple god worship today, with wacky deities that supposedly do even crazier stuff than men. Unfortunately, we do, and it's called neo-paganism. Our modern-day world is seeing a revival of witchcraft as neo-paganism. This pagan worship, including that of the Greek gods, is making a comeback. In fact, Greece estimates the following to be at least 100,000. Instead of gathering together to worship the one true God, these people are literally worshiping the Greek gods. Here is a video transcript of them in action.
Male-focused television magazine host. You know, the Greek gods are the best gods. All they do is bang and beat each other up. Our Greek officers went to find the people who still worship these awesome deities. A group of people are in a circle, with a man pouring what looks like milk, over a rock. Narrator. Some call them pagans and heathens. Others dodecatheists. Woman. It was very important to me, the fact that after almost 2,000 years or so, the hymn to Poseidon was heard again. Interviewer. It's Saturday night, and we're not out for drinks. We've come to the lodge of the High Council of the Greek Nationals to meet some very religious people. But they don't believe in Christ and Virgin Mary. This is one of a few dozen unions of dodecatheists in the country. It's probably the oldest and most popular one. Group leader. Tonight we'll engage the virtues of stability and modesty. Interviewer. What do you believe in? Group leader, we believe in what Greeks believed throughout history, before Christianity. Therefore, in what Pericles, Leonidas, Themistocles and our philosophers believed in. Interviewer. What are the basic principles of this religion? Group leader. We are not monotheists, we don't believe in one god but in many.
Interviewer, like Zeus and Athena?
Group leader. Yes. It is a national religion, it's linked directly to the Greeks' religion, and it was formed by those who were called Greeks.
Interviewer now back outside.
Tell me about the procedure. Man. We stage the altar, then we'll get dressed and then we'll get started.
Interviewer. What will you wear?
Man. We'll wear some clothes, you'll see them. The women are dressed in white togas and men in white shirts and pants. They are holding bowls with rock and flowers. A man singing.
O God Phoebe, torchbearer king who talks through the tripod. Interviewer. It's a sacred time for dodecatheists, that's why we're lowering our voices.
They've already done the libation.
They offered milk, honey, and other liquids on some rocks which are probably the altar.
We watched them singing their hymns intensely. Man, at ritual. Thecent is the universe of the sky and the sea seeing Phthonic kingdom increased, hornbearer fertile pan. Narrator. Now they're chanting. They all seem very excited and people stand quietly. People singing. We call for you, we praise you. Narrator. Real devoutness. Nature helps a lot.
I got to know them, even for a few days, and understood that they're ordinary people believing in a certain religion. Anyway, most of us wouldn't even consider or question everything they did, in fear of being punished by God or Zeus.
Yeah, I guess that's Greek humor, but isn't it crazy to actually see people today going back to ancient pagan Greek worship of gods that acted no different than sinful man? When we put all this together for the days we're now living in, including this revived pantheistic attitude, a polytheistic mindset of worshipping many gods, do you think it will aid an inevitable future man, who will appear on the world scene and tell us to worship him as a god? Will these people with that mindset object? They are probably going to be excited because it will only confirm their thinking that the gods have somehow come back to us. This rise of neo-paganism and witchcraft, and unfortunately, along with the Roman Catholic Church's behavior, is preparing people for acceptance of the Antichrist and his dirty deeds. We are seeing it happen today. In the next chapter, we will keep moving forward in witchcraft history, to the Roman culture. Again, witchcraft was rampant in Rome because they adopted it from the previous civilizations. So, it is no wonder that those getting saved in the early church were burning their witchcraft tools.